Our first speaker is Richard Davila. He's a doctoral candidate in media studies at Western University, currently writing a dissertation on the contribution of Chicanos Chicanas to the history of punk in the United States. His paper is called, and it's a new title, Making Do, DIY in the East Los Angeles Backyard Punk Scene. Richard.
Thank you. So, in the study of labor and punk music, a nearly taken for granted notion is that a do-it-yourself or DIY ethos in that type of approach to cultural production stems directly from punk's rejection of and desire for autonomy from the mainstream music industry and a capitalist economic system more generally. For those punk musicians who commit to a DIY ethos, therefore, the refusal to sell out to the major labels becomes a public declaration of integrity and a marker of authenticity. However, the assertion that DIY is based on a rejection of the major label system rests on two assumptions. First, that major label interest exists or could conceivably exist for any particular scene. And second, that DIY cultural production is at least as ideologically motivated as it is practically so. In this paper, I will argue that the vibrant backyard punk scene of East Los Angeles, California, that flourished in the mid to late 1980s reveals and challenges these assumptions. This is because the DIY practices employed by members of the scene, which might be referred to as a kind of making do, arose as much from being ignored by labels as from a rejection of, them. Punk groups from East LA, a predominantly Chicano and working class region of Los Angeles, have historically had limited access to Los Angeles punk clubs and have likewise attracted very little interest from record labels, whether major or independent. There's disagreement in the community about the role that race and class status may have played in their neglect, but my research indicates that these factors appear to play a significant role. With little interest from outside, East LA punks used the limited resources available to them to create their own DIY networks in which bands performed at parties in neighborhood backyards and distributed their music through homemade cassettes. The East LA backyard punk scene demonstrates that for musicians who don't fit easily into the narrowly defined divisions of the mainstream music industry, as well as for those who lack the material resources to enter either mainstream or independent music markets, DIY cannot be reduced to a willful or intentional refusal of the major label system. My research suggests that DIY also appears as a necessary mode of cultural production for those who fall outside the lines. In this paper, I first provide a brief overview of the ways in which scholars have attempted to define DIY. I then use the failures of the first generation of bands from East LA to introduce some of the problems Chicano punks face when approaching the music industry on both corporate and independent levels. Finally, I outline the practices of the subsequent backyard scene in order to argue that DIY should not be understood solely as a rejection of the mainstream music industry, but also as a carving out of space for those who are ignored by it. Punks and scholars alike largely agree that a DIY ethos is a central tenet of punk cultural production. While the specific terminology varies, the general consensus is that a DIY ethos informs certain types of cultural practices through which participants struggle to achieve a measure of autonomy from the profit-driven, corporate-controlled mainstream music industry. Amy Spencer puts this rather succinctly in her History of DIY Culture when she defines DIY ethos as the urge to create a new cultural form and transmit it to others on your own terms. Likewise, Sarah Marcus defines DIY as both a philosophy and a way of life that sees art and culture as vital forces to be struggled with and shaped, experimented with and created, breathed and lived, rather than as commodities to be passively consumed. Stacey Thompson takes this even further, arguing that DIY, quote, can be understood as a set of problems that unfold from a single contradiction between punk, understood as a set of cultural productions and practices that comprise an aesthetic field, and capitalism and the commodity, an economic field and an economic form in which punks discover that they must operate, end quote. Jason Middleton presents a similar argument in his study of the Washington, D.C. punk scene, suggesting that the DIY approach to commodity exchange employed in the scene actually mirrors capitalism in some ways, so that DIY cannot be seen so much as an effort to break out of capitalism, but simply to develop a space of relative autonomy within it. This assumption that the punk commitment to DIY is driven by a desire for autonomy is precisely what I want to challenge in this paper. This assumption, which conflates DIY with anti-capitalist ideology and practice, privileges those scenes whose members have the economic and social capital to choose to reject the mainstream music industry. More specifically, scenes whose members are predominantly white and middle class. This assumption is contradicted by the early attempts of East LA Chicano punks to enter the market on both mainstream and independent levels. East LA punk bands like The Stains, The Undertakers, The Brat, Los Illegals, and others began to form around the same time as more widely recognized and celebrated bands from the early Hollywood scene, such as the Weirdos, the Germs, the Plugs, and the Bags. After playing in rented halls and at backyard parties and car shows for a number of years, the bands found something of a home in the Vex, the only long-running punk venue in East LA, which existed in several different locations between March of 1980 and September of 1983. Much like many of their Hollywood compatriots, these bands often hoped to land record deals, and as they established themselves on the scene, they began to attract a certain amount of label interest. The Undertakers recorded an album for Roadhouse Records, The Stains for influential DIY punk label SST, The Brat recorded an EP for Fatima and had plans for a follow-up full-length on Capitol, and Los Illegals were picked up by A&M. However, while these groups were able to attract label attention, The Stains and The Undertakers from independents, The Brat and Los Illegals from majors, none were able to translate this interest into sustainable careers or commercial success. The Undertakers broke up before their album was released, and it was shelved for nearly 20 years. Likewise, SST delayed release of The Stains album, recorded in 1981, because of commitments to other larger bands like Husker Du and the Meat Puppets. The band broke up soon after recording the album, and it was shelved until 1983. In a personal interview, Jimmy Alvarado of Razorcake magazine argues that had the album been released while the band was still active, giving them the opportunity to tour in support of it, The Stains could have been at least as successful as label mates Black Flag, with whom The Stains played many shows and to whom they were often favorably compared. These are typical examples of problems bands face when working with small, independently operated labels. But the examples of The Brat and Los Illegals, who found themselves working with major labels, suggest a different set of problems faced by Chicanos in the music industry. After receiving substantial airplay on alternative rock stations in Los Angeles and selling a considerable number of copies of their EP around Southern California, The Brat landed a development deal with Capitol Records and recorded 15 songs with Paul Rothchild, famed producer of The Doors. The songs were never released, though, because the band was dissatisfied with the Latino rock sound that the record company wanted to push them toward. As Rudy Medina, lead guitarist of The Brat, reported in an interview with Alvarado, "Some producers had this fantastic idea we should have maracas or fucking castanets because we were a Spanish band, or all Mexicans play with castanets, I guess." In another interview, Medina said of lead singer Teresa Covarrubias, "They would have wanted to see her with a fruit bowl on her head." For Los Illegals, the story was very much the same. While the band found themselves on A&M Records, their album, released in 1983, was a commercial failure, partly because the label was unsure of how to promote a band with a strong political stance informed by an East LA Chicano experience and with lyrics in both English and Spanish. Much to the band's chagrin, the label directed most of its promotional efforts specifically to Chicano communities in California and the Southwest. But this marketing strategy, which assumed a more or less universal Chicano experience, proved to be a flop, as Chicanos from other regions couldn't always relate to the experiences of East LA Chicanos. From the perspective of the band, a more effective strategy would have been to target younger audiences in both Chicano communities and on university campuses. Jesse Vela, bassist for the group, suggests that Los Illegals needed to do twice the work of other groups because the band not only had to do the usual work of recording and touring, but also had to educate the label on how to market them. In both of these cases, what is apparent is that the assumed audiences for Chicano or Latino groups working with major labels, regardless of musical style or regional specificity, are Chicano and Latino communities. This racialized assumption proved very limiting for the groups and contributed to each group's eventual demise. As this first wave of punk bands from East LA faded out, though, new bands were already emerging to take their place. In step with the greater LA punk scene, many of the new bands that emerged in the early to mid-1980s, bands with names like Bud Acne, Blood Cum, Malignance, and Copulation, shunned the arty experimentation of many early LA punk bands, instead playing in the faster, more aggressive, hardcore style of punk. Alan O'Connor argues that bands that adopted this new style effectively removed themselves from the field of commercial rock music, since from a major label standpoint, this new style was virtually unmarketable. He states, quote, "For some of the bands, this may have been a conscious decision, but for many young bands, it simply resulted from the desire to compete with other underground bands and to play faster. They just didn't care," end quote. While O'Connor, like the scholars to whom I referred earlier, defines punk's relationship to the market as principally a struggle for autonomy, this statement also acknowledges that this is not always a conscious or intentional decision. This in turn opens up a space to discuss DIY in ways that transcend the seemingly definitive statements about anti-capitalist orientations noted earlier. I want to use this space to suggest that the DIY cultural labor occurring in the East LA backyard punk scene may have been as much a consequence of and necessary response to limited access to resources as it was a willful refusal of the mainstream music industry. So what were the conditions to which the East LA scene was responding? One of the biggest difficulties faced by bands in East LA during the mid to late 1980s was the lack of reliable venues. By September of 1983, the Vex had closed for good. Since the Vex was the only dedicated punk venue in East LA, this presented a serious challenge to bands wanting to play not only in East LA, but in other parts of Los Angeles as well. Alvarado notes that many bands from East LA, as well as from Orange County and other parts of the Los Angeles area, had used the Vex as a type of springboard into the more established Hollywood scene. The Vex thus served an important role in providing bands with club experience that they could then use to gain entrance into the Hollywood club circuit. While the members of the East LA bands that were taking shape in the early to mid-1980s likely attended punk shows at the Vex, many of them were simply too young to be able to play there themselves. Since previous club experience was a prerequisite to play many of the clubs in Hollywood, for these bands, the closing of the Vex was therefore synonymous with the closing of doors into punk clubs anywhere in the city. While the lack of punk clubs in East LA and the subsequent lack of club experience made it difficult for bands to find gigs outside of the area, it also meant that bands had to seek out alternative places to play within East LA. Although backyard shows were already happening in tandem with the Vex, the closing of the Vex meant that backyards became the primary location for punk shows. As Alvarado says, the mechanics of these shows were simple. Quote, find someone whose parents were either gullible or out of town, make flyers, pass them out at LA punk venues, show up at the house with a couple of kegs of beer, play, dance, fight, leaves when the cops crash the party, and find someplace else to finish the beer, usually an alley close to home. For $3 or less, one could see, depending on when and if the cops showed up, anywhere from 1 to 8 bands play, end quote. By 1986, there were backyard shows happening every Friday and Saturday night, sometimes even more than one each night. At this point, Alvarado says that listening to and going to see bands from other parts of LA took a backseat to what was happening in East LA, allowing the scene to become self-supporting. This generation of the East LA backyard scene, and there have been many since, this is an ongoing phenomenon, but this particular one began to decline around 1989, when some of the bands discovered a no-talent night at a downtown club called Al's Bar, which enabled East LA bands to network with bands from other parts of the city, thus creating new opportunities to play outside of the neighborhoods. But from the period of roughly 1983 to 1989, punks in East LA were able to build a sustainable network of performance spaces in response to a lack of access to more official spaces. As Alvarado's description of these venues indicates, though, the use of unsanctioned spaces for shows created additional difficulties, most notably regular police interruptions. Another difficulty faced by the East LA bands was how to record and circulate their music. While O'Connor states that each generation of punks discovers that it is not difficult to record songs and have them pressed, the dearth of vinyl recordings to come out of the East LA scene suggests that, on the contrary, it may have been quite difficult for bands from the working class neighborhoods of East LA to make records. O'Connor stresses that the low cost of pressing a 7-inch record means that bands can recuperate expenses selling a limited number of copies. However, as Alvarado says, young bands in places like East LA are perhaps less likely to have access to the kind of disposable cash necessary to invest in pressing a 7-inch, even if they would eventually make their money back. This may be especially true for bands that were effectively shut out of higher paying club gigs, since gigging is a common way to raise money for recording and pressing records. It is, after all, difficult to pay for record pressings in beer, which was a frequent form of payment for playing at backyard shows. Cassettes, therefore, became the common format for the circulation of home-recorded music in the East LA scene because they're a cheaper alternative to vinyl records. As Alvarado says, quote, few of the bands went into a proper studio, and even fewer released a proper record. Most instead made demo cassettes on either a 4-track recorder or a ghetto blaster, copied them onto cheap cassettes, and passed them out to friends or sold them. A handful of other would-be music moguls sometimes took these demos, picked a few songs from each tape, recorded them onto other cheap cassettes, and passed them off as compilations, end quote. What this demonstrates is that punks in East LA engaged in practices that could be described as DIY, but that these practices arose as much from necessity as from a conscious commitment to a DIY ethos as described by Marcus, Spencer, Thompson, and Middleton. Along with Michelle Habel-Payan and Tomas Ibarra-Frusto, Alvarado compares these practices to rascuache, a Chicano art aesthetic. Rascuache, which loosely translates to making do, is understood as a primarily working class aesthetic and refers to artistic practices based on using whatever materials are at hand, often creating new uses and meanings out of discarded household objects. Making do is perhaps the clearest, most concise way to describe the approach to cultural production of punks in East LA during the 1980s. Denied entry to the LA club circuit, East LA punks built their own performance circuit in the only available spaces to them, their own backyards. Likewise, with little label interest and lacking the economic means to press their own records, they made use of the cheaper cassette format to circulate amateur recordings made on four-track recorders or portable stereos. So to return once again to the definitions of DIY offered at the beginning, at the core of each of these, is the idea that the driving force for DIY cultural production is a desire for autonomy from the mainstream culture industries. In the case of the East LA backyard scene, though, autonomy was not so much achieved through struggle as it was assured from the start, based on the material realities of those involved, specifically the reality of coming from an economically and racially marginalized area of Los Angeles. As Alvarado says, quote, when you're 14, 15, 16, even 22, 23 years old, and you've got no money, and you've got no prospects, and you've got no hope in hell of even being able to conceive of anybody paying attention to you, in that sense, it's not something that you're trying to rebel against, it's just a reality, end quote. The early failures of labels to successfully market Chicano punk bands, the general unmarketability of the type of punk being played at the time, and the lack of access to sanctioned performance spaces and material resources all combined to assure that Chicano punks in East Los Angeles in the 1980s could operate with a high degree of autonomy. But whether or not this autonomy was desired is another question. Speaking of his own band, Bud Acne, Alvarado notes, there was no way that we were going to get a record deal and we knew it. There was no way that we were going to get a club date and we knew it. And we didn't care. We were street kids. We didn't care about those things. This statement implies that perhaps many punks in East LA, like many of their counterparts in the greater punk scene, weren't concerned with mainstream recognition or commercial success, but it also implies that this disinterest might be rooted in the knowledge that record labels and club promoters had little interest in what was happening in East LA, an ambivalence that seems to be both born out of occupying a marginalized position in society and at odds with the supposedly ideological motivations of DIY cultural production in other scenes. What I want to therefore suggest, based on this discussion of punk in East LA, is that up to this point, attempts to theorize DIY as a form of cultural labor have perhaps been too narrow. The definitions with which I began this paper generally come from works about more widely recognized and predominantly white middle-class scenes, such as those in Washington, D.C., Seattle and Olympia, Washington, and the greater Los Angeles punk scene. But none of these definitions can fully account for the kinds of cultural production that occur as a result of the material conditions of a place such as East LA. Perhaps then it is necessary to reconsider the accepted understanding of DIY as a specific form of cultural labor with clear ideologically undergirded desires and goals, and think of DIY instead as a range of cultural practices that arise from a variety of circumstances and to serve a range of purposes. On the one end then, we might find a band like Fugazi, who remained committed to a DIY ethos as a means toward authentic experience outside of the mainstream culture industries, in spite of being pursued aggressively by major labels. On the other end are marginalized groups like the punks in East LA, for whom autonomy is never a question, and therefore for whom DIY becomes a necessary and practical means of cultural production, a making do. The space that is opened up by conceiving of DIY cultural labor in this way allows for an escape from the kind of romanticizing that so often occurs in discussion of DIY, thus enabling us to consider it more meaningfully and with greater nuance.
Thank you very much, Richard. Who's going to start the discussion?
I'm wondering what happens as the punk band mature and backyard parties are maybe not the right venue anymore. And I'm also wondering how more contemporary technologies are impacting the kinds of opportunities or lack thereof. I'm really interested that yesterday we were talking about how there's a lot touted about the internet being able to make greater opportunities, but maybe that's not always quite the case. So I'm just curious whether the punk groups are finding something similar.
So the first question was about older people as they are. So, yeah. So it did happen that some bands eventually were able to establish themselves. Not many from this particular generation, but from a later generation in the 90s. For instance, Union 13 was able to sign to Epitaph, which is one of the bigger independent punk labels. But I think a lot of people, as they got older, sort of phased out of the backyards. A lot of people ended up in a movement that was called the Chicano Groove Movement, which involved a lot more sort of traditional styles of music, sort of more hybrid forms. But yeah, a lot of people sort of left the backyard scene as they aged, but a lot of younger people were coming in as older people were leaving, so it's sort of kept going in different iterations pretty much ever since. In terms of how the internet has maybe enabled some of these bands to get wider recognition, I'm not really sure about how current bands are using the internet to their advantage. That's something I'm planning to look into, but I haven't gotten to that point in my research yet. But I think that the internet has played a role in helping some of these bands from the 80s to get some recognition. It's hard for a lot of them because there are no recordings available. So, you know, if you're only recorded onto cassette, cassettes degrade and they're difficult to transfer to digital. So, you know, there's not a record of a lot of these bands, but for some of the bands, like particularly the first bands that I was talking about, this first generation, I think that a lot of those bands are getting a lot of recognition now, like the Brad especially and Los Illegals are getting a fair amount of recognition because the internet has allowed them to get their name out there a little more. And there's also been a resurgence in academic interest in that particular moment in particular. But.
You mentioned that the practitioners were ambivalent about talking about grades in class and accounting for their experience. Why do you think that is?
I think part of the reason is that there are certain bands, for instance, Los Illegals have made a big deal about the role that they think race played. They kind of felt as if they were shut out of the Hollywood scene specifically because of their race. And I think that there's disagreement within that scene, so bands like The Undertakers don't necessarily feel the same way. The Stains didn't really feel the same way. The Brat sort of agreed with Los Illegals, but I think Los Illegals, the members have been the most vocal about that. And I think that it caused quite a bit of controversy. There was a pretty heated debate in the Los Angeles Times between Brendan Mullen, who was the owner of one of the early LA punk venues called The Mask, and Willie Heron, who is the lead singer of Los Illegals. And I think that some people kind of want to distance themselves from that. I mean, it seems like some people never felt personally targeted, and so they're not going to say they did if they didn't. But it seems like there's been some ambivalence as a result of potentially as a result of the debates that have been happening. It seems as if people don't want to blame the race issue, even if they seem to tacitly acknowledge that there might be some truth to that. They don't seem to want to make that bold of a statement. I don't know if that, does that answer your question?
Yeah, I'll go get this up. Could you expand a bit more on the difference you would see, and that's like the core of your paper, so is it the difference between making do and you want I, which I think is an interesting twist, because in French maybe equivalent or phonetic, which is not the same thing as do it yourself.
Yeah.
It's, as you said, it's making do. And I think it brings into different sets of issues. So could you just expand a bit more how this thing came about? Because from what I understood, it's something that the participants were saying they did. So
So I think, I guess from my research, what seems apparent is that a lot of people seem to rely on finding creative ways in the Chicano punk scene. I should say in the East LA punk scene, because the East LA punk scene, while it's predominantly Chicano, isn't entirely. It is a fairly diverse scene. So a lot of people, I think, were kind of having to find these creative ways to do things just because that was the only way they could. An article about a band from a later generation called Social Conflict, a member of the band was talking about the way he made recordings and circulated his recordings was there was a church, a Christian church in the neighborhood that with sermons in Chinese language, and he would go and sit through the sit through the service, pretend he was there for the service. And then afterwards, there was this big box of devotional cassette tapes in a Chinese language. And he would just take a bunch of them. They were free, so he would take a bunch of them, and I'm assuming put a piece of tape over where you punch out the tab, and then record his own music onto it in order to pass it out. So I think that, you know, you see these instances of people doing things that, you know, in other scenes, like for instance, in Olympia, Washington, there was the K Records scene and all of that, and they were really devoted to cassettes as a cheap alternative. But it feels different somehow. It feels as if they, you know, they have this idea that cheap recordings are somehow more ideologically pure, whereas in this other instance of stealing tapes from a church, you know, it just seems to be an instance of this is what I have to do if I want to get my music out there. So I don't know. Is that?
No, absolutely.
I'll ask. I just want to kind of piggyback off that comment, but yeah, I'm really interested in what you're saying. I think it's very fascinating or stimulating point. You know, the criticism of the DIY as autonomy. But I guess I'm sort of curious if there aren't more positive reasons why, because I mean, you're sort of implying that if they were accepted into this scene or into, you know, the industry, they would have like sold out or something, or they would have been willing to do whatever, you know. So I can't help but think there's sort of a negative way of seeing
sure.
how they imagine the DIY ethics there. So I feel like maybe there's sort of a contradiction there.
I think there it's sort of varied. I mean, I think it varies always. People talk about DIY as being sort of ideologically pure, but I don't know that there's ever been a moment where that was actually true for everyone. And so I'm certainly not going to make the claim that anyone who wanted to move up to a bigger label would be selling out. I think that's a claim that is made often, but it's not one that I would make. But I think I think that some people did actually from this scene. Some people might have liked to. And I don't mean to say that none of the members of the backyard scene actually wanted to move on to something else. I think some people very well could have. So I didn't mean to paint it with too wide a brush. But in the earlier scene, Los Illegals really did, for instance, they really did think that signing to a major label was the best way to circulate their message. So you know, they didn't think of that as selling out. They thought of it as a bigger platform to spread a message that they thought was important to have heard. So I guess it's a thing that varies from case to case. So,
yeah.
Does that address
that? Thank you very much, Richard.